Jesse's open mic. And so I'm Deborah, and I'm with the library, and this is Tom Rowe with the radio station. If you have questions about either one, you can see us. There's lots of information about the station. We're encouraging people to become a founding member. It's $25. Or if you just want to make a donation, that's great too. Whatever, and we're welcoming you all here and hope you have a good time. I think we're going to have some poetry first and some readings. We've been fortunate to have a creative writing class with author Esther Cohen, and some of her people in her writing group have come to share some of their work. So first is Michelle Curtis.
Everybody here, thank you. Just wanted for a moment to say how much we as a group appreciate everything that the Carroll Library has done. And yeah, Deborah, it's amazing, amazing programs that Esther has given her time. This is our second year of having the group, and we just have a ball and wonderful time, so I hope you enjoy this a little bit. I'm going to do a poem and then a piece of prose. Kindness. Kindness. My cat's paws, one on each side of my face, as she looks into my eyes as I cry. Kindness. The lady telling me to go ahead of her in line because I look so tired. Kindness. Me telling a man to go ahead of me in line because I feel so rested. Kindness takes a second, lasts forever, has no discernible value, is worth so very, very much. From my earliest memories, I was aware that he was not perfect, but it didn't matter in the most important ways, because he was perfect for me. People always assumed that he was highly educated through schooling, and often thought that he was a doctor, but neither was true. He was independent as a young man, and when his wish for a better education by attending Catholic high school was denied by his father, he refused to go to the public high school and began the process of educating himself. When he was 15 years old, he experienced the tragedy of his mother's death, and that same year, he joined the family business to become a lawyer, specializing in workman's compensation, and he was considered one of the best in the state of his time. He fought for and helped so many people, although in the end, he sacrificed some of his dreams and happiness, for he worked in a career that he excelled at, but that did not bring him the joy that he craved. I didn't know this when I was young. I didn't find out all the missing pieces of my father's dreams that I sensed but he never told until the last months of his life, when he felt compelled to share with me the stories of the years after his youth and before he met my mother, the stories that filled in the puzzle of my father as the man he had been and the man whom I knew. There were the stories of his first wife, whom I knew about but knew nothing of. He told me that while my sisters and I were growing up, he felt that it would be confusing for us to have details of his life with another woman, so he had just disclosed the basic facts. Now he exposed their life to me. He related their fundamental differences in values and his profound disappointment when he discovered that she couldn't have children, that she knew this before their marriage, that for the 13 years of their marriage, she had lied and pretended to be trying to fulfill his deep need for children of his own. He told me how he had pursued and obtained an annulment of the marriage from the Catholic Church, this man who could not be considered religious by any standards, but who needed to know in his own soul that complete dissolution of the marriage had occurred. And he revealed to me what I believe was the most important story, how he had the opportunity to fulfill his greatest dream aside from having children, the opportunity to buy a horse farm and riding academy, how he approached his father for support and time, how his father ridiculed him, belittled him, and refused him yet again, how he was defeated and could not find the strength to defy his father just one more time, how he gave up all hope that this dream was possible to attain in his lifetime. But as I said, I didn't know that when I was young. and growing up. The father whom I knew expressed great joy and lightheartedness in our relationship. From the day I was born, he sang Irish and American folk songs to me. When I was little enough, he walked back and forth with my head resting on his shoulder and sang me to sleep. When each sister was born, they took the place on his shoulder, and I lay in bed and listened, trying to stay awake until he finished the songs that I knew so well. I had him to myself for the first 4.5 years of my life. His love for me caused his imagination to soar. We were father and daughter, but we were playmates too. He would come home from work, and as he walked through the door, he became Dr. Kane, and I became Nurse Tab. He would immediately ask me which patients were on the schedule and what their ailments were. We were lost in a pretend world, and I loved it. I learned that make-believe or real, I could say anything, feel anything, be anyone, and it was fine with him. As my sisters came along, our world expanded to include them. He changed the words of nursery rhymes, poems, and songs so that they were about my sisters and me. He skipped around the house with us, playing games and singing songs. His joy in seeing the world through our new eyes was something that deeply moved me and that I would never forget. He made sure that we experienced all the magic of childhood at home and out in the world. Along the way, he managed to teach me skills to help me maneuver through life. So much of his wisdom has guided me and come to be appreciated and understood by me as I grew and matured. He was a brilliant man in some ways, yet he often wasn't able to apply his knowledge to his own life. He adored my mother, but the marriage failed, and although he tried, he could not find a way to save it. His weaknesses took over his existence at times, and he could not find a balance. It was a period when there was little recognition that feelings and hidden pain could interfere with behavior. He knew that his weaknesses could spin his life out of control, but he could not understand it or find the solution to fully living his life in a healthy way. Once he knew that there was no chance of renewing his marriage with my mother, he made the decision to devote his life to his children. He went to work, but the rest of the time was strictly routine. His only social life involved going places with me and my sisters. I always knew where he was, what he would be doing, and how to reach him. If I needed to talk to him, he was available. He had always been the cook in our family, and he continued to cook dinner every night that I was with him throughout my teenage years, as well as every holiday. I cannot remember one complaint from him about his routine, and I believe that he had no regrets about that part of his life. I hope that this glimpse can allow you some idea of the complexities of this wonderful man. Each day that we spent together, he presented me with so many gifts that have served me in my adulthood, and that is where my attention has always been directed. I never expected him to be perfect. I always knew that he had failings. I looked to him for what he could offer me, and I know now that it was so much more than I understood at the time. He loved me then, and I know that he loves me now, as I am, without reservation, and with his whole being. I cannot imagine a more perfect father for me. Before the next person comes up, I'd just like to tell you currently I have been writing a blog entitled Take Care of Your Health. My purpose is to offer my perspective of how each of us can become and remain healthy. Drawing from my 20 years of experience as a healthcare practitioner, I'm sharing practical information and ideas. So if you'd like to take a look, the blog is available online at the address michellecurtis.blogspot.com. That's MICHELECURTIS, blogspot.com. Thanks so much. And next we have Nancy Henry.
Thanks, Deborah and Tom, for this also. This poem is called Andrea. I felt your pain through your voice, your words. I tried to carry you to the other side of pain, focusing you on your perfect addiction to the joy of living. The first time you mentioned Greg House, I did not know who he was. I loved how you'd say anything. You were more than entertaining. The truth about how cancer sucked resonated with us all. When you first got disability, you felt a little undeserving, perhaps. You were so vital. No photos of me on mountain walks in case those disability detectives catch a glimpse of my wellness. You plan to walk the hills with dogs and friends for years to come, outsmarting cancer and your doctors. How can I be so tired? Why can't I remember that? We all recognized ourselves in your words. You had plans to go abroad. Things are happening in Cuba, things that aren't done here. We encouraged you to pick up and go. You were tired. Too many choices, too many doubts, too many drugs. Your breathing became more labored. We felt you slipping away and tried to hold you with a strong grip of mind and spirit. When our friend Blaze became too exhausted to stay, he reached toward you, wanting to continue your artful banter, exposing soul truths. I think he took your hand and you both agreed. What a relief. What freedom. Loving friends on both sides played a great tug of war for you. We all wanted you on our side. Pain is past. In the spirit world, your immortal, playful essence delights our memories. What is it the child in the woman cries for? The terrible knowing ruins the plan of heaven, where all resolutions can happen. The terrible knowing knows the parents will not be child again. The terrible knowing, uncertain though it would be, knows and knows and can't stop the growing knowing, growing to conclusions refused by the mind. The artist is only a man, the man in me trying to move the woman over. Be still, woman. Be untorn. Unmoved as a cold ocean, moving, moving, moving. Once I had a neat place and fitted for one while there and saw a felt of goodness and thought it dwelt there neatly by my doings and leavings. The leavings destroyed the neatness and war broke out. The war exploded in our hearts and our minds could not fix the damage. And though treaties were signed and all agreed the war was over, the blood did not stop flowing. Something beautifully gruesome was born and died in that instant. Something like a star. Stars are frightening if you think about them out of context of moons and dreams of girls on porches in home-sewn dresses. The threads were fine in those days. All the music flowed into the clothes through the threads and the ideas of comfort and beauty. I forgot how to clothe myself, and I sit naked with blue veins and red spots and dark blotches and yellow bruises. I sit missing my beauty. My wheat is overripe. There is no one to free this ground. There is no nourishment without water. The water is afraid. Its job is too great and cannot be done by oceans or streams. We need the milky tears to please us, the silk before sin, the living eyes. We want it one way without the flowing of in and out and the agony of the knowing, the eating. The sun is too hot, the moon too cold. We seek the perfect place where nothing exists for real, except the eating, the eating, the eating, and the waste. The waste will feed our future, we are quite sure. We turn away and let the others know the knowing, but they only deceive us and grow in the murky waters of deception. The scar cannot be hidden by the clothes. The scar over scar over scar becomes what we are, and the healing doesn't help. The healing, peeling, and the throbbing And we say no, and we create it over. But our gods have been dead a long time, and only the milky tears can revive them. You know who's next, buddy? I'm not sure who's next. Oh, Dean's next? Dean.
And I think I neglected to mention that Tom is streaming this live on at WGXC.org.
A couple of fragments. Art History 101. I think what he was saying was just go out and paint. Paint what you see. But remember, a tree leaf is as important as a face. Give it the same attention. He almost starved. He was not the best painter, but he had integrity of the greats. I think his work in the early 70s was the high point. A book of his work in 1872 in color, that's what I want. The later work is maybe more accurate, experimental, mature. But something happened in 1872. Don't take my word for it. Go look. Put yourself there, by the water. It will do you good. A little nature right there in front of you. And another fragment. We followed him into Snakebite. He poled, and we paddled. The sun appeared, a golden dot, then a ball, seeming to rise out of the Florida Bay. The pale blue sky filled with warm pastels. Only a canoe or a kayak could make it through the shallows. We came to look at the birds. He had brought his net. He was looking for crabs. He had wintered in the Everglades for years and years and knew Snakebite. There were two channels, one through it and one that followed the coast. If you didn't know the tides, you could end up high and dry until the next flood. Steve was a park ranger and a naturalist. It was easy to be comfortable following him. Standing in the canoe as he poled, he was always the first to see the crabs. In a smooth movement, he put down the pole, picked up the net, and caught the crab. Thank you.
Thank you, Dean. Next we have author Esther Cohen.
Thank you. I want to say thank you to the radio station and to Cairo Public Library, which is my favorite public library in the universe. So I'm really happy to be here. I'm going to read a story which is a lot longer than what other people read, so if you want to stand up for a second. You can also stand up while I'm reading my story. It's okay. It's from a collection of stories I'm writing this summer about upstate New York, little towns in upstate New York, and this story is inspired by a Jane Austen quotation. The quotation is, "Every man is surrounded by a neighborhood of voluntary spies." So there's several people in the audience tonight who are going to recognize a lot of the details in this story, and I hope that most of you do. When we heard that people from Brooklyn bought the small, funky church hall down the road from us, really from Brooklyn, we all moaned and sighed. Hipsters moving into our neighborhood, artist hipsters who were turning an old church hall into a loft and using words like elegant. The church was beautiful the way it was, hadn't been a church in years, it's deserted, an old sign in front saying, "Free will offering." When we first moved here, hairdressers, ladies, mostly Methodists, would walk into the space with her honeyed hams every Saturday afternoon, and by 5, the parking lot was full, hams consumed. The entire community had eaten at least one good slice of pie from blueberries or cherries or peaches, and supermarket coffee brewed in one of those gigantic metal coffee makers, coffee for 48. Hipsters and other species of being, especially careful hipsters who homeschooled their children and used the word local in relationship to food, who were certain and self-righteous, and who did not allow white sugar anywhere in the vicinity of their significant loved ones, who'd rather die than eat a piece of pie. We were the hipsters once, 20 years ago when we bought our house in the small village of Middlefield. We were the smug outsiders here to turn someone else's home, a place we bought, into our version of paradise. More hippie-ish than hipsters, we were more of the anything-goes school. Live and let live within reason, our philosophy. We've always eaten plenty of pies. Still, we had our sanctimonious moments, our heritage tomatoes, our small, perfect, self-righteous zucchini blossoms, our scrape the walls to what they should be, instances of quasi-perfection. But the hipsters seemed worse. We watched them get out of their car. The man was actually holding a copy of Paul Auster, his wife, a paperback novel by Auster's ex-wife. Did they only read Brooklyn authors? Was even that legislated? It's not that I do not have my good and bad books. I do. But the summer we moved here, I read an essay in my dentist's office. I hate the dentist and have some degree of dental phobia. Just sitting in his chair and having a stranger check around has always made me really nervous. Still, I love my real dentist, George. He's just about the most good-natured human being alive, and he never even raises the subject of flossing. He mostly discusses white water rafting and his wife Naomi's ex-husband Jack. I forget my teeth when I visit George, which is a good thing. My teeth are forgettable. He had an odd magazine in his office years ago. Patients gave him a subscription, give him subscriptions for Christmas gifts. I picked it up because of its title, Moon. An essay inside was written by a high-powered man, a CEO type A kind of guy who decided to drop out and just to be, whatever that even means. So he left his job and moved upstate to a small town 60 miles southwest of Buffalo. He lived in an open and unfinished barn. His first summer he went to the auction and he bought boxes of books for a dollar. He said the books were unpredictable, books about canning and canoeing, about astronomy and Mormons. He read 6 novels he'd never heard of and liked them all. He called it pure reading, and doing this formed the heart of his life. For months and months until he was able, he said, to remove himself from all the big influences, to feel like he was back in touch with who he really was and wanted to be. I stole that magazine from George the dentist, although I wrote him a note telling him that I had his Moon. I knew he didn't care, and I copied that article in a Xerox place and gave it to everyone I knew. It seemed like one of those pieces that are important forever. I walked down the road to invite the hipsters to dinner. If they were bikers or hikers, I'd have invited them too. They came to the door, earnest and sincere, and I thought to myself, what's so bad about them? They were wearing black clothes. Black is okay. It's better than okay. Their new church loft was stripped of the ladies of any vestige of pies. Siena and Rome were their names. So what if they chose them themselves? Their parents probably didn't have all that much imagination. I didn't want to ask what they did, but they told me anyway. 3D imagining installations. I'm not sure what that means as a job. Avatar is 3D, but my guess is they did not work on Avatar. Everyone who did probably lives in Brooklyn or LA. I Googled imagining installations, but couldn't find too much. What was there was written in some new obscure, those words that mean nothing language. And I went back to feeling there's nothing too good about being a hipster. Even so, I was absolutely committed to inviting them to dinner. Nick asked me if I would have invited them if they'd worked for the phone company, moved in from Gloversville, put plastic pots with plastic plants on their front lawn. I'd like to believe the answer is yes, that anyone who moves in should come by and have a meal, but I'm not sure that's entirely true. Would I invite someone who is a supporter of Sarah Palin? Probably not. Anyway, I walked over to the hipster's church loft home and noticed that the outside was a different color white than it was when it was a stand-in for the old Methodist church. I had to think about that for a while. Was there anything intrinsically wrong with white? Half the people I know have had their teeth made whiter in the last few years. Now their mouths have that fake Clark Gable-y glow-in-the-dark look that they claim takes 10 years off their life. Would I be equally critical of a color I cared nothing about? A color in the negative column like Wellfleet Periwinkle Blue? Was I somehow secretly competing with the youngish Brooklyn hipsters, making rules that only I could win? Or was the over-earnestness, the humorless self-focus that I imagined about their lives even real? They appeared at our door and introduced themselves, Sienna and Rome. Sienna was the woman, although it could have gone either way. How she looked was careful, thin and pretty. She looked like a woman who knew her aged cheese. She had different earrings in each of her ears, non-silver metals that did not dangle. They just hung down purposely, as though she could control their swinging. Come in, she said, more Tilda Swinton than Rosemary Clooney. Do come right in. It was the do that made me feel like I'd never like her much. Do what? Do enter? If she said please, would I have liked her better? She offered me filtered water, explaining that their well had an excess of sulfur. Ours does too, but we drink it. We live a few doors from one another, but it could be countries. On the other hand, our Methodist neighbor Beulah, of multiple light blue pillbox hats, maker of peanut butter pies with old-fashioned Crisco, the same stuff that probably coats your arteries for a lifetime, is just as odd. Though Beulah maybe seems to have a little more zest. She had 5 husbands. Sienna seemed like Rome, and she were glued. Welcome to Middlefield, I said, and then I felt stuck. My follow-up was equally feeble. It's beautiful here. Sienna stared thoughtfully and seriously, giving me the benefit of the doubt, maybe, and maybe not. She looked in that expectant way that makes you feel you should say something important or at least interesting, and you just can't. You can't help but continue with platitudes. What a summer, I continued. I never talk about weather, not really, but I felt at a loss. It's been so hot. It's a little cooler today. She looked as horrified as a hipster could be, unbelievably cool. And then, because I just wanted to leave, I said in a tone of voice that sounded insincere, even to me, please come to dinner. Okay, she said, but we don't eat sweets, especially pies.
Series of stories into a radio program, so stay tuned for that. Esther's books are available through the Cairo Public Library and the Mid-Hudson Library System, and I will just remind you that library cards are free. I think we have one more person to read a poem, Tony Fallon, and because we can't have open mic unless we have Tony Fallon, and then we have a bunch of music coming up, so stick around.
It's working. Good evening. She said we can't have open mic because I'm always here, a pest trying to get on the air, right? Is that it? Anyway, my name is Tony Fallon. A lot of people think when they hear my first name that I'm Italian, but when I open my mouth, they realize I'm not. When I came here this evening, I saw two people that I've known for a long time. I did radio down Long Island for a long, long time. I started a radio program in 1978. And I had a lot of help. And I started thinking about it when I saw Dennis Rowley, because Dennis was a big help to me. And I started thinking about this new radio station. And you know, when the radio station goes on the air, the people who will have programs will all get known. And some of them, of course, will have to buy bigger hats because they'll have bigger heads, etc., I assume. But yeah, the people who are doing the shows have got to remember that the people behind the scenes are the people who keep you on the air. If you don't have engineers, etc., etc. So I want them, people who are on the air, to remember that, that the people behind the scenes are the people who are keeping them on the air and the people who are doing a lot of work and getting very little recognition. Anyway, speaking of Dennis, Dennis helped me a lot with the radio program out in Long Island, but that's not why I want to mention Dennis. Dennis played a game called hurling, and I don't know how many of you are familiar with it, but it's a game with a ball and a stick, and you hit the ball with the stick. That's about very simple, because it's a much more complicated game than that. I think Dennis is actually the world record holder. He was still playing that game when he was 62 years old. Dennis, take a bow. Now, this isn't just some little game, you know, which you can, like golf, you know, which, well, you know, somebody here might say golf is a strenuous game. But this you have to run in it, and you have to hit the ball, and other people hit you too, which, so, anyway, that's enough of that. I want to tell you a little story. This mic is what mic is.
Is this nice? You want to try that one?
Yeah.
Is this working?
It is.
Okay, that's better. Okay, this is a little story about two priests who went to Hawaii on vacation. When they went on vacation, they decided before they go that they wouldn't dress daytime, nighttime, or anytime like they were priests. They would be going as civilians. And they wouldn't dress in any way, they wouldn't wear any medals or crosses or anything like that to so as they would be recognized. Because they didn't want people asking them questions or whatever. So the first day they go out on the beach and they're sitting there on the beach with nice pair of black togs on them, etc., etc. And they notice this blonde girl over there every so often glancing at them. And when the evening comes, she passes by, and as she's going by, she says, "Hi, fathers." And they're saying, "How could she possibly know we were priests?" And they look at each other and they said, "The black togs. You know, somehow or another wearing black and making us look more like priests." So that evening they went to this store, they bought very fancy togs, they bought hats, sunglasses, the whole thing. And they went back to the beach the next day. And sure enough, the blonde is over there again. And she's glancing at them. And whatever. And a couple of hours later, she gets up to go for a soda. And as she goes by, and this girl doesn't have a lot of clothes on. I forgot to mention that. And as she goes by, she again says, "Hi, fathers." And they're going, "My God, the glasses, the hats. How could she possibly know it?" So as she comes back, they stop and they say, "Excuse me, how did you know we were priests?" And she says, "You don't recognize me? I'm Sister Catherine from the convent." One more religious joke. The Pope gets a phone call, and the person on the other end says, "This is God." And he says, "I have some good news for you, and I got some bad news for you." He said, first of all, the good news. He said, over the centuries, religion has caused a lot of problems in the world because one religion thinks they're better than the other or what have you. We were not going to go into all the details. But he said, "I've decided that instead of having all these different religions, we'll have one religion." So the Pope says, "That is fantastic. We've prayed for that all our lives." And this is the answer to everybody's prayer, just to have one religion so there wouldn't be so many problems. He said, oh, by the way, what's the bad news? And God says, I'm calling from Salt Lake City. You're out of a job. Okay, now we're going to try poetry. I've been writing poetry a long, long time. This is one that I wrote five or six years ago. And I change it when I'm in different towns. And this is about a couple who own dogs, and they're walking them on the street. And they have a lot of dogs. And for some reason or another, they call all their dogs Rover. So they're an Irish couple. And they're walking the dogs in Cairo. So here goes. A couple were walking dogs one night in Cairo town. The wife, she came from Mayo, and the husband came from down. Said the husband to the wife, I'd like to buy some food, but to eat with a dog in a restaurant would be considered rude. Quick as a wink, they hatched a plan. They thought it couldn't fail. And in the wife walked, her dog beside with a wagging tail. She sat down at a table and told them she was blind. They told her she was welcome, and her dog they didn't mind. Soon after that, the husband walked in and sat at a different table, prepared as was his wife before to tell this awful fable. But the waitress spied him quickly and became very agitated, and soon this gallant lad was being loudly berated. She quoted rules and laws of the city's health department and told him loudly to depart to his home or his apartment. She didn't believe the story, and she didn't like his bow-wow. And you couldn't really blame her for that, because he just had that chihuahua. And so he left in shame. I think he was a fool. He should have said that there was a big mix-up at the blind dog school. And so he is at home with all his other Rovers, while his wife is sitting in the restaurant, eating her Dovers. That's what they call poetic license, I guess, right? Thank you.
Thanks, Tony. I do want to remind you that this is open mic, so if there's anybody who would like to perform, if you would just notify Tom or myself, we'll get you on the agenda. Next we have an up-and-coming band, a local band, called American Monarchy. And we have Mike Model on lead guitar, Mike was at lead vocal, David Auger on lead guitar, Nick Anander on bass, Matt Schlosser on drums, and Alex Jacobs on rhythm guitar. So let's give them a big welcome.
song. The name of it is 99 Red Balloons. Hope you enjoy. It's a throwdown song.
It's a cover song. All
set them free at the break of dawn, till one by one they were gone. Back at base, bugs in the software flashed the message, something's out there floating in the summer sky. It's 99, red balloons go by.
Specials, a whole mess of them, and Hope you guys enjoy.
Less
talk,
more rock.
That's true.
I'm gonna stop.
Thank you.
this is going to be our final number. We're going to switch things up once again. You are going to be amazed by Mr. Dave Osher on lead vocals.
Oh, yeah. Is everybody having fun tonight? Everyone enjoyed the poetry from before? That was a lot of fun. I can see my friends just arrived. They took the wrong exit. It took them a half hour before to get here. It was really too bad. So. Oh, okay. Some people know this song.